We all make mistakes. I've made half a dozen today already. There was that typo in a tweet I sent that now I regret. And there was me too quickly and confidently hitting send on that tweet when I know I sometimes make typos. And now, I think the mistake is me dwelling on the mistake. But had I not made that typo, what would I be talking about right now? Does my silly mistake have redemption now as I write an introduction to today's Saturday matinee? And if it does, was it a mistake at all? We all make mistakes, and those mistakes make us. That's something we're exploring in today's Saturday matinee with an episode from the podcast The Constant, A History of Getting Things Wrong. In this show, host Mark Chrysler looks at the accidents, mistakes, and bad ideas that helped misshape our world, like the breakfast cereal magnate who spent his fortune dynamiting the sky, or Marie Antoinette's reliance on a hypnotist, or the mobster who tried to break out of prison by having his corpse electrocuted. In the first story you're about to hear, Mark begins by asking, why do birds disappear in winter? A question with an obvious answer now, but not so long ago, had quite a few people making mistakes. I hope you enjoy. And while you're listening, be sure to search for and follow The Constant, A History of Getting Things Wrong. We put a link in the show notes to make it easy for you.
That sound you're hearing is spring beginning. The song of the robin. And soon enough come the sparrows. And the terns. Until by summer, a cacophony of martins and warblers and herons. Do herons sing? A very different set of bird calls dominate fall. Leading to winter. A world practically bereft of birds. Well, almost. Some cardinals and other stragglers. And pigeons. But I digress. That silent dead of winter prompts a question. Where do all the birds go? This is The Constant, A History of Getting Things Wrong. I am Mark Chrysler. And this first episode is Why Do Birds Suddenly Disappear? They fly south. That's the answer. Birds fly south for the winter. Thank you for listening to The Constant. Join us again next week when we'll be asking, are thumbs useful for holding things? And it is insane to me, contemporary Mark, that I broke a convention that I had not yet established in the first 4 minutes of the first episode of this show. But maybe that's indicative of something. Hold on. Quick follow-up. How do you know about the birds? I know why you think you know. You see geese flying south. Ta-da. But do you? Have you ever checked? Because a lot of times, if you check, you'll notice that they're flying southeast, or east, or west, or even north a little bit. After all, they don't just fly straight down all day until they get tired and then just land any old place. And hey, how far exactly have you ever tracked a flock of geese traveling? A couple of miles, maybe? Besides, what do geese have to do with the sparrows and the terns and the warblers and the herons? Of course we know the answer to the question, but we shouldn't mistake that for meaning that the answer was obvious. We know because we have records of observations carefully collected, because we're in communication with people throughout the entire world and transcontinental travel, radio transmitters, documentary film crews, ultralight aircraft. For thousands of years, people grappled with the question without the aid of those things. Looking back at the answers they concocted, it's tempting to laugh. So remember, it's not obvious. Ask yourself what you would have believed. And then go ahead and laugh. We don't have much of an idea of what people thought happened to birds early on. The Old Testament twice references birds going away in the winter, but doesn't offer up any explanation of why or where. It isn't until the Iliad that we get a hint of what ancient peoples were thinking. In it, Homer remarks about cranes flying to southern Africa to do battle with pygmies, but he doesn't bother to expand upon that. In fact, he mentions it offhandedly as a simile for the ferocity of the battle at Troy, which seems to indicate that this idea, whatever it was exactly, was already in popular circulation at the time. Fast forward 800 years to around 70 AD, and there's Pliny the Elder, the premier historian of the time, who still believes in Homer's crane-pygmy war idea and gives us more details on the subject. He says that for 3 months out of the year, the pygmies eat nothing but crane eggs, lest they be overrun during the annual winter war at which they ride rams and goats. This fantastical idea refused to disappear softly. Although it lost significant favor in the next few hundred years, it was still a somewhat common belief at least into the 1300s, when it is mentioned in the travels of Sir John Mandeville, the most popular travel guide of the Dark Ages, which is even less trustworthy than it sounds. But that's just cranes. Even the Greeks didn't have enough mythical races on hand to explain the absence of every species of bird that migrates. And when the Greeks didn't have an answer for something, or even when they did, that meant it was time for Aristotle to poke his obnoxious head in. And in the initial version of this episode, I go on a long, qualifying, complimentary streak towards Aristotle. At this point, we don't do that anymore. But let's say hey. Don't get me wrong, Aristotle was great. One of the fathers of philosophy and science, student of Plato, teacher of Alexander. Aristotle's thoughts on empiricism and formal logic, not to mention ethics and government, are among the most beautiful, brilliant, and enduring notions in human history. But the guy could not stop. He comes up with theories for everything he sees or hears or even just thinks of, and a lot of it is embarrassing. The brain's function is to air condition the body? How low testicles hang? Determine the pitch of the voice? Stop, Aristotle, just... You're making it hard to love you with how embarrassing you are. The love is long gone by episode 100. On our subject, Aristotle has two main answers, one of which is actually pretty brilliant. He reckoned that some birds transformed their shape, size, and plumage to adjust to the changes in weather and foliage. So, redstarts metamorphosed into robins, garden warblers into blackcaps, etc. Which seems like a weird conclusion to draw, unless you're living your whole life around ancient Greece, which European robins fly to in the winter right around the same time as redstarts push off for sub-Saharan Africa. See? That's actually pretty brilliant reasoning. Aristotle's other idea on the matter is far less fun, and it's the one, unfortunately, that persists the longest. For all the birds that came and went without having some other species coming and winting at the opposite times, Aristotle says that they're just hibernating. Most birds, he said, must tuck themselves into little holes in cliffsides or hills and snuggle away the winter months in slumber. But swallows, in particular, he inexplicably reasons, dive down into lakes and ponds and rivers and dig themselves into the muddy bottoms, where they freeze, thawing in the spring. Aristotle's hibernation idea caught a strong tailwind, in part probably because hibernation is something people knew about. Bears and bats and skunks and snakes and bees and groundhogs, lots of things hibernate. Why not birds? But part of the reason this idea persists for pretty much 2,000 years must come down to deference to Aristotle. Like humors and the four elements and ether, if Aristotle said it, most European thinkers assumed it was true, even if they'd never seen a single piece of evidence to suggest it. But people did see swallows wintering in lake beds, or at least they heard about seeing them. In 1555, the Swedish Archbishop Olaus Magnus wrote in his influential book, History and Nature of the Northern Peoples, about fishermen pulling up nets of hibernating swallows. Okay. So here's the gold. Swallows burying themselves underwater and cranes fighting imaginary miniature men is all fine and good, but it's in the late 12th century that this stuff gets really good, because it's then that the Archbishop of Brecon, Gerald of Wales, has his incredible epiphany. And it is deliciously wrong. Gerald, can I call him Jerry? Jerry noticed a couple of things. First of all, he noticed that just before all the geese disappeared, they could be found congregating near lakes and rivers. Secondly, he noticed that many of these geese congregated on fallen tree branches, which I guess so, if you take a really elastic definition of many. Thirdly, he saw that when those same tree limbs got waterlogged, these interesting-looking barnacles grew on them. And by interesting, I mean vaguely looking like the neck and head of a goose. So Jerry concludes, yeah, you're right. That thing you're thinking he couldn't have concluded because of how ridiculous it sounds? You're right. That's exactly what he concluded. Geese transform into barnacles. More than that, since he'd never seen a goose egg or nest, he figured that not only do geese transform into these barnacles, but that they are barnacles, born that way. That geese aren't even actually birds at all, but crustaceans. Oh, well, that's not right. Hi, this is Mark from the present, and Gerald definitely didn't call geese crustaceans because the word crustacean didn't exist yet. In actuality, Gerald put geese into an even more dumbfounding category, the same one he and everybody else put barnacles and crabs and lobsters and the like into. He called them fish. Jerry published this screwy bunch of nonsense at the tail end of the 1100s, and people reading it obviously think, of course. They eat this flibbertigibbet up with a knife and fork, literally. Since the archbishop had declared geese to be shellfish, that meant that good Catholics could eat goose during Lent and on Fridays. Maybe that was all the incentive people needed to take Jerry at his words, because this one really catches fire. This isn't some oddball, cockamamie thing somebody shouted on a street corner. William Turner, one of the fathers of ornithology, and John Gerard, among the most influential herbalists in history, are both still saying that geese are barnacles into the early 17th century. Eventually, the Pope had to intervene in order to get people to stop eating goose on fast days. But importantly, he doesn't say Jerry is wrong. He says that since the barnacles act so much like birds, they ought to be treated as if they are. Even today, the bird and mollusk species Jerry observed are known, respectively, as the barnacle goose and the goose barnacle. At the turn of the 18th century, every idea, from Jerry to Aristotle, was embraced simultaneously in a confusing patchwork of aggressive inanity. But the tide was shifting. With the Enlightenment upon Europe, an English minister and natural philosopher sat down to straighten out the issue, once and for all. Charles Morton read accounts from sailors and travelers, observed the movements and flocking of various bird species, and realized swallows weren't burying themselves in lake beds, and geese weren't turning into barnacles. They were escaping the cold and seeking food. They were migrating to the moon. So close, Chuck. Morton's argument is well-reasoned and somehow manages to be both closer to correct and more hideously wrong than all the preceding theories. Part of the problem certainly stemmed from the widely held belief that all heavenly bodies must contain life. Why would God have created huge planets and moons and stars only to leave them barren? And Morton noticed that at night, he sometimes saw birds flying down from in front of the moon. He figured that once they flew out of Earth's gravitational pull, they could reach speeds of about 125 miles per hour, reaching the moon in 2 months or so, sleeping most of the way. This is 1703, and the best theory we've got is they go to the moon. That's a lie, of course. It's not that nobody had thought that maybe birds fly closer to the equator in winter and away in summer, but it was just an idea. An idea without the gravitas of Aristotle, or the blessing of the church, or the trenchant reasoning of a well-intentioned 18th century natural philosopher. Are you wondering? Do you want to know when we figured it out? You want to make a guess first? 1822. 1822. The United States has already fought two wars. Electricity is being crudely channeled. The Watt steam engine is in common use. It takes until a year after Napoleon dies for someone to work out that birds fly south. And who finally figures it out? We don't know. We have the full name of the moon guy and the lake bed dude, but the closest we have for the real answer is one word. Filestorch. On May 21st, 1822, in Mecklenburg, Germany, a man, we don't know his name, woke up early. He dressed for wet and cold. He cleaned and prepared his gun. He hiked out to a gully by a pond and made a blind there, where he sat, still, silent, and patient, for hours. and then he heard it. The rattling call of his quarry. Our hunter raised his gun, cocked his hammer, took aim, and fired. Smoke from the muzzle almost obscured the faint flapping fall of a marvelous, wide-winged white figure tumbling earthwise like an angel found sin. Our hunter rose slowly and walked across a field, on the lookout for his kill, a white stork. But when he found it, there was a surprise in store. The stork he just killed had already been shot before him, impaled with an arrow still stuck clean through his breast, up his neck, and out just beside his ear. If you stood the bird up, it looked almost like it was carrying an arrowhead flag high above its crown. Pfeilstorch, German for arrow stork. I don't know what this hunter thought, if it seemed funny to him, or maybe it was a bad omen, a curiosity, maybe, but whatever the instinct was, he took his unusual catch to the University of Rostock, where the faculty quickly realized the arrow had come from sub-Saharan Africa. This stork had been shot by an arrow somewhere around Kenya and had flown with the spring, arrow attached, all the way north to Germany, only to be shot again, this time by a blunderbuss. But in so doing, the Pfeilstorch, do you mind if I call him Phil? Phil gave us the knowledge that historians, deacons, ministers, scientists, and Aristotle had failed to. Let's call that a commercial break. The first breadcrumbs show up during World War I, when a chemist at Johns Hopkins was inventing a way to synthesize silica gel. Today, you probably know it from those little paper packets you're not supposed to eat, but during the Great War, it was needed in quantity for gas masks. In his experiments with the synthesized material, Walter Patrick noticed that sometimes, when he used this silica gel to soak up water, some small amount of it resisted being absorbed. A few more crumbs over the next couple of decades. An American grad student in the 20s writes a dissertation on water that is adverse to evaporating when placed in tiny, thin, long crystal vials, or capillary tubes. Then, a researcher in the USSR finds a similar phenomenon in the late 40s. Blips. Curiosities. Nothing to take note of, and no one much did. Even in 1961, when an obscure Soviet scientist on the edge of Siberia began pumping distilled water vapor into capillaries, it wasn't important research. Just a tiny few drops of water in some tiny little quartz tubes. Nothing to start an arms race over. Except, it did. This is The Constant, A History of Getting Things Wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler, and this episode is my best title of all time, 1% Inspiration. The experiment looked like this. Nikolai Fedyakin placed these tiny syringe-like tubes in a sealed box with a bit of water underneath. Then he pumped the air pressure out of the box, causing the water to evaporate and the vapor to condense back into liquid water in the tubes. But when he pulled the tubes and put them under his microscope, he noticed something strange. At the ends of the tubes was something... well, it's something like water, but not... it was thick and sticky, like maple syrup. And it didn't freeze or boil like water. It stayed liquid down to negative 50 centigrade. Didn't boil at less than 400. And even when it eventually froze, it didn't behave like water. It contracted instead of expanding, becoming almost crystalline. What was this stuff? And how was he creating it? The tubes had been sterilized, the water distilled. The only possible answer was that Fedyakin had somehow happened upon a new, mysterious form of water. Which would be a big deal, but, and I don't mean to pick on him, but it's important to emphasize, Fedyakin was a nobody. He didn't have the clout to properly herald his discovery. The best he could do was to publish in a fairly obscure Russian language journal, But that article happened to catch the attention of Boris Duryagin. You'd be forgiven for not knowing Duryagin. Lord knows I didn't before working on this story 3.5 years ago, but he was one of the foremost accomplished and revered chemists of 20th century Russia. When Duryagin read Fedyakin's work, he rushed his obscure colleague to Moscow and stole it. Basically, Duryagin had the reach and expertise to do what Fedyakin couldn't, and Fedyakin didn't even have the power to register a complaint, as Duryagin sidled his way into full credit for the discovery of this new super substance. It was in 1966 that Duryagin announced said discovery at England's Faraday Society. The next year, he presented similar results in New Hampshire. The Brits and Americans were initially skeptical. After all, what were the odds that water, one of the most abundant and studied substances on Earth, would hold a secret so long and then give it up so easily? They laughed at the Russian, if a bit nervously. But some couldn't help but admit that the experiment seemed solid at first glance. Duryagin detailed for the world how he was farming this new substance, which he was doing in far greater quantities than the cast-off Fedyakin had managed, and a couple of Western researchers were curious enough to say, "What the hell?" and give the method a shot, if only to confirm that Russian science was full of inferior crackpots and that even the great Boris Duryagin had lost his mind. But that isn't what they found. Both the American and British teams set up their first round of experiments. They sanitized their quartz capillary tubes, forced condensed water vapor through them, and waited for 18 hours. When they came back, there it was. On the edges of the tubes, this strange, syrupy, super stable water, which had been called anomalous water or offspring water until the Americans stepped in, as Americans are wont to do, with better marketing. And thus, poly water was born. And man, was it a hit. When the American team published their first paper in Science confirming the fantastic properties of poly water and hypothesizing that the water was taking on a plasticine crystal structure, the story exploded. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post. By 1970, every major paper and magazine was agog with stories about the new wonder water. Corporations and universities clamored for a commercial application, but most fascinated of all were the militaries. The American Navy held conferences, while the Defense Department created grants, all out of a concern that there was a poly water gap with the Soviets. No one was quite sure what to do with the stuff. Maybe it would be antifreeze, or maybe a coolant, or a lubricant, or maybe it would desalinate water. But whatever it was the stuff was good for, we couldn't go having the Ruskies getting more of it than us. Then there was the other concern, that poly water was something more directly deadly and dangerous. In Kurt Vonnegut's Cat's Cradle, he thought up a substance called Ice-9, a form of water that was solid at room temperature, and which eventually converted all water on Earth and killed off almost all life. Some members of the scientific community were concerned that poly water could get loose from the lab and spread, just like Vonnegut's sci-fi story. But while most experts were busy thinking up uses for the stuff or calling out hypothetical dangers, there were some who still maintained niggling doubts. At the University of Southern California, Dennis Rousseau had been taken by the flurry of research and started trying to make some poly water for himself. He particularly wanted to try to settle one still open question about poly water, its spectrographic signature. The major players in poly water, Duryagin in Russia, as well as a British team in London and an American one in Boston, had all attempted to figure out exactly what poly water was via Raman spectroscopy, shooting a laser into a sample and measuring the spectrum of light it emitted. Every substance has a unique signature, and the results from the three teams had been inconsistent. The Brits said it had the same signature as water, while the Russians and Americans showed a unique, uncatalogued substance. Indeed, Rousseau confirmed this. Whatever poly water was, it wasn't something they had a spectrum signature for. But he didn't stop there. Rousseau ran analyses for contaminants and found some odd stuff mixed in with his poly water. Sodium, calcium, potassium, and chlorine. But where were these contaminants coming from? All the tubes were sanitized, all the water distilled. Was he doing something wrong? Was everyone? He couldn't work it out. And then, during an intense game of handball, Rousseau had his eureka moment. He took off his sopping t-shirt, wrung it out into a container, ran the container to his lab, shot his argon laser at it, and took a look at the light emission. And there it was. The same signature. Polywater was sweat. Miraculous, concentrated, ordinary scientist sweat. Every lab across the world had been doing their best to keep their experiments clean, but they hadn't sterilized themselves. And while they were setting up their high-temperature water vaporization, it never occurred to them that they were also vaporizing tiny little beads of their own perspiration. Rousseau published his findings in 1971, on the heels of hundreds of scholarly papers about polywater, millions of dollars spent between the two great superpowers to achieve sweat supremacy, and talk of a Nobel Prize for Duryagin. Nobody, not Boston, not London, not even Russia, bothered to argue. The truth was right there, before their very eyes, and beneath their sweaty brows. Boom. This is The Constant, a history of getting things wrong. I'm Mark Chrysler. Today's episode, 3 years of Sundays. This is the story of two men, separated by more than 200 years, among other things. The first is Marin Mersenne, a French friar born in 1588, whose genius spread itself thinly across a range of human endeavors. He worked on astronomy with Galileo, philosophy with Descartes, math with Pascal. He wrote tracts on theology, against mysticism, dutiful correspondences for the Old Testament. His correspondences, advocacy, and work is credited as laying the groundwork for the Academy of Science. He invented the Afocal telescope and discovered the arrangement of the two-mirror telescope. But he is best remembered today for two areas that he changed fundamentally: prime numbers and music. Mersenne is known as the father of acoustics, having figured out various rules, laws, and theorems for music theory and audio perception. When I look at the sheer and staggering breadth of Mersenne's work, I can't help wondering if he saw the whole of his universe as a giant orchestra he was working to subtly and divinely conduct. Or else perhaps the great-grandmother of all string instruments, stretching its innumerable and harmonious tendrils out across all of Europe, while Mersenne worked a melodious bow over it all. And one of the striking high notes of his symphony was what came to be known as the Mersenne primes. Numbers he had determined to be indivisible via the most elegant of calculations. Prime numbers have always contained a certain magic about them. They start so easy, numbers that have no factors other than themselves. So, 3, 5, 7, so far so good, I hope. 11, 13, 17, 19, 23. Have I done all right this time? 29, yes, 31, doesn't stay easy for long. And even today, there's no foolproof universal way of predicting prime numbers, and no way to test whether a number is prime, but to sit down and do the long division on every possible factor, one by one, until you finally determine that none work out. I mean, we let computers do that work now, but the computers have to do it. There's no formula available to us or computers to cut down on the effort. But while there's no holistic system for determining all prime numbers, Mersenne discovered an equation that allows us to quickly discover some of them. The equation is simplicity itself. Take 2 to any power, then subtract 1. So, 2 squared is 4, minus 1 is 3, 2 cubed is 8, minus 1 is 7, and on and on. Now, 1 less than every power of 2 isn't prime, but many are. It's a group of numbers far more likely to be prime than other random integers. And Mersenne dedicated 2 years to creating a list of numbers that he had determined to be prime through his formula.
2 to the second power minus 1. 2 to the third power minus 1.
Including a couple of staggeringly huge numbers.
2 to the 31st minus 1. 2 to the 67th minus 1.
That right there. 2 to the 67th minus 1? That's a really big number. That's more than 20 times the number of grains of sand in the whole world. That is nearly as many atoms as there are in the universe. Written longhand, it adds up to, deep breath, 147 quintillion, 573 quadrillion, 952 trillion, 589 billion, 676 million, 412,927. And that is the number that Frank Nelson Cole scratched out upon a chalkboard on October 31st, 1903. Cole was, let's say for the sake of narrative convenience, the opposite of Mersenne. Where Mersenne was social, Cole was solitary. Where Mersenne's interests were broad and diffuse, Cole's was singular and focused. Where Mersenne saw music in everything, Cole saw it in but one. One thing. The only thing. Math. He studied math at Harvard, then lectured there. He taught math at the University of Michigan and at Columbia University. He wrote papers on complicated and abstruse mathematical phenomenon, stuff that reads like sticking your nose against an endless brick wall to the layman. Because the density and complexity of pure mathematics was Cole's true love. On that Halloween day in 1903, in front of the American Mathematical Society, Frank Nelson Cole displayed the depths of that love, the music his heart sang for math. The presentation was entitled On the Factorization of Large Numbers. Dry stuff, to be sure, but Cole had a large crowd regardless, as he was the secretary of the society and the editor of its regular publication. The audience settled into the lecture hall, and in strode Cole, wordlessly. He approached the chalkboard and wrote out Mersenne's famous gigantic prime number by hand. Then, still silent, he stepped to the other side of the chalkboard and wrote out two much smaller, though still ridiculously large, numbers, one on top of the other. And then, the music. For the next hour, Cole did the multiplication, longhand, like you learned in third grade. The hall sat in breathless silence while Cole virtuosically laid out digit after digit until, finally, there it was. 47 quintillion, 573 quadrillion, 952 trillion, 589 billion, 676 million, 412,927. Mersenne's famous prime wasn't. Cole drew the equals sign between his math and Mersenne's and took his seat. He had given an hour-long conference without saying a thing. The audience burst into applause. A standing ovation, actually. It's no secret how Cole managed to disprove Mersenne's prime, and it's not a matter of intellectual heft either. You could have done it, or even me, and I can't do prime numbers. All he did was write down that gigantic number and try to divide it. Long division, over and over, with numbers as small as 238 to the number that eventually worked, 193,707,721. Cole was a genius, but his genius was a non-factor here. Only assiduousness, temerity, patience played parts. When asked how long it had taken him, Cole admitted he had spent every Sunday dividing factors into Mersenne's prime for 3 years. This story is an exemplar of human conduct. One man hones a great idea, an idea that ever so slightly brightens a tiny dark corner of human ignorance. Because of him, we all have available to us a piece of knowledge that wasn't there before. 200 years later, a different man devotes himself indefatigably to making sure that that other man was right. Not out of animus, not out of jealousy, not even out of a hope for fame, but simply because he wanted us to be sure. And when he issued his correction, the world, or some small piece of it at least, celebrated. Mersenne and Cole is a story of getting something wrong, sure. But more importantly, it's the story of people doing things incredibly, beautifully right.